Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance on Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Well, let's get straight to it with Francis Donald, the Global Chief Economist and Strategist at Manulife Investment Management. Francis, an easy one. What did you make of that?
That's not an easy one, John, because there's a lot of parcel through there. But the main takeaway for me is, yes, we could talk about terminal rate estimates and the pace of hikes, but what I'm hearing is just more data dependence. And myopic data dependence can always be dangerous, but is particularly problematic in an environment where we have weather distortions, seasonal adjustment distortions, low survey responses. We are in data that is really having trouble sending us a clear signal, at least over the long term. And I'm concerned that we're going to see markets that are overreacting to data points that have false precision, and potentially even a central bank that's moving too quickly and making big policy changes, even via communication, off of data that I think is going to be very bumpy in the next 3 to 6 months.
Francis, with the shock that we saw yesterday, does disinflation come to the rescue? Can we get a rapidity of sharply lower inflation?
You know, I think the Fed may not be focused on specifically some of those traditional inflation measures, but that rise we've seen in inflation expectations and market-based measures, that's what's keeping me up at night. That is moving in the wrong direction. Now, it's countered by inflation expectations among consumers that are still going lower. And I'm hoping that the Fed is focusing on those long-term inflation expectations, which are coming down quite a bit.
Exactly.
One of my bigger concerns is this summer, we're probably going to lose some of the disinflation momentum. That's largely going to be base effects. So this downward momentum that we've seen is probably going to stall. That's when we're going to start hearing those words like stagflation come back. And if we haven't seen some slowdown in jobs by then, a Fed that's going to stay hawkish through the summer.
After what was wrought yesterday, is it walk it back Wednesday? I mean, does he come out today to the House and change the tune a little bit?
The only way we're going to walk back this pricing for the March meeting is what we see in the jobs data in the next few days. And when I say jobs data, I mean we've got jobless claims, we've got job openings, we've got challengers, ADP, NFP. It's a like variable buffet of jobs data that's going to be coming through. And no one number is going to be, I think, more important than the sum of those stories, especially in an environment where we're really trying to dig deeper. We got to look at private sector jobs data right now, people looking at job postings on things like LinkedIn and Indeed. If you want to understand what the Fed is going to be doing a year, 2 years from now, which I think is even more important than the March meeting, you got to be looking at all of the data available and really making sure that you understand the comprehensive story behind it.
Francis, I understand what a bind Fed Chair Jay Powell is in, how unique this moment is, and yet the flip-flopping of his messages is jarring. It's jarring for markets and it's jarring for people who are trying to get a sense of what the compass is for this Federal Reserve. Do you think that that in and of itself is detrimental or advantageous, given that that uncertainty actually creates some of the market conditions that are potentially tighter than they'd otherwise be?
Well, it certainly makes our job harder, Lisa, because instead of saying, well, they've provided forward guidance and we can kind of rest on our laurels for 6 months, we have to be a lot more flexible when it comes to the data that's coming in. But there is a lot of short-termism in this industry, in financial media. When you're an economist, you're always looking for what is the next big story, and I don't want to miss that inflection point. But problematically, we have a lot of data that's moving, you know, two steps forward, one steps back, and it's getting dangerous to extrapolate too far in the future. We have portfolios that are trading tactically, and they need to be moving off of that. But if you're a longer-term investor, a lot of this is noise that's distracting from the signal. You need to be focusing 12 to 18 months, or even in some cases, we have to produce five-year forecasts to tell us where our strategic portfolio should be positioned over the very long term. And so some of this focus on the Fed moving back and forth in a month-to-month basis, it's not valuable to investors, and sometimes it can actually be distracting, in some cases even dangerous.
Where do you think the market is getting the economy wrong right now?
I'm not sure the market's getting the economy wrong. Again, it depends on your time frame. So Q1 is certainly much stronger than many people expected. That consumer is holding in strong. But the challenge comes back to, and I've heard a lot of your guests talk about this, where are we going to be down the road? And it is very difficult to discount the probability of a recession 12 to 18 months from now. So if we're talking about the next 3 months, sure, there's no problem in saying this economy is stronger than we expected in November and December. But if you want to argue for no recession, you have to discount almost every single leading indicator that has very reliably predicted a recession later in the year or 12 to 18 months. You can try to do that. We have a very different labor market. We have excess savings. But from my view, it's a very hard sell. One thing you can say is that the leads and lags in this economy may be different than what we've previously expected. But I would just really focus on your timelines. Are you talking about the economy in the next 3 months solid, or are you talking about the 18-month outlook? I think a lot of strategists, including myself, need to work on really being clear about their timelines for their forecast.
Francis, and their degree of confidence around each timeline. Do you have more confidence about where we'll be in 6 months than maybe where we'll be next week after CPI?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's actually the game, is what does the economy look like 12 to 18 months from now? And actually, I'm concerned about that. I think it's going to look a little more stagflationary than we'd be comfortable with. I'm less concerned about a technical recession. We know the playbook to trade recessions. We know what those look like historically. I'm more concerned about 18 months from now. We've been in a very slow growth environment for a pretty extended period of time, and we have inflation stuck around 3 to 4%. And problematically, the inflation that's rested in the system that's still there is likely to be less interest rate sensitive than the inflation that we've managed to kind of dissipate over this period of time. So this word stagflation, there's lots of ways to define it. There's lots of ways people can talk about it. I think that's going to be more of a theme for us moving forward than we thought it was going to be even just a few months ago.
Francis, wonderful, as always, to get your perspective. Great to see you. Francis Donald there of Manulife Investment Management.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
We're lucky this morning. We've got Kelsey Barrow from JP Morgan with us. Now, Kelsey thought she'd get a clean slate, come here to speak on behalf of Bob Michael and the team. Then Bob Michael got in there first and said this to Bloomberg. So, Kelsey, I've got no idea what this is about. But here's the quote from him. He thinks that if we go back to 50, it would be pretty confusing to the market. I hope they don't do it. I hope they're willing to run a string of 25 basis point increases. Now, Kelsey, thanks for being with us. The chairman's opened the door to 50. Mm-hmm. How problematic is that?
Yeah, so if you think about the way that Powell's been communicating about getting restrictive, right, there's three dimensions to that. There's the pace, there's the level, and then there's the duration. And what Powell has been doing for months now is saying, okay, we've hiked a lot, and so don't worry about the pace so much. It's about the level that we get to and the duration at which we stay at that restrictive level. Yesterday, he essentially threw that out the window. That is confusing. And I think the key takeaway is that if we are going to consider reaccelerating to 50 based on the data, and they are very data dependent, the risk of a hard landing does go up in that scenario. And the yield curve is telling you as much. What we saw yesterday, 12 basis points higher on the 2-year, flat on the 10-year, break evens narrower. The yield curve, 2s, 10s, getting to minus 100. That is the risk of over-tightening that the bond market is picking up on. And that's also why you're seeing very sticky resistance on 10s at 4%, which is something we've been watching and saying, yeah, people are interested at bonds, even in this repricing. The yields are there, and the diversification benefits are going to become even more important if the Fed is going towards that hard landing scenario.
Ben Emmons agrees with Bob Michael. He writes this morning about the importance of the level we're at right now. Does that level indicate restriction? Does that level indicate not the drama of super restrictive, but that we're finally at levels that really click in?
Well, this is obviously the debate. Now, we think that we are getting to levels that are sufficiently restrictive. So last year, the thing that I was always quoting was the real Fed funds rate. So saying that the Fed wasn't going to stop hiking until the real Fed funds rate turned positive. So essentially, you needed the Fed funds rate to move above the level of inflation. We are making progress on that. You know, if you look at core PC, it's around 4.6%. The Fed is now expected to get to 5, maybe 5.5. That's going to be a significantly positive real Fed funds rate. And I think we have to think about the way in which policy impacts the economy. It impacts housing first, then manufacturing, then consumer and labor. And it's actually playing out in that traditional way. Housing, home prices have been deflating for 6 straight months. Business investment is starting to rolling over. Now, what's only left is the consumer and the labor market. It just takes time. We have the patience as long-term investors that the Fed may not have the luxury of having in this moment.
Yeah, I was going to say, perhaps patience that the Fed doesn't have. Right now, I'm looking at a 10-year yield of about 4%, just under that. And you were talking about value in bonds. Are yields at this level on the longer-term debt instruments pricing in a soft landing of sorts, with rates remaining higher for longer and no crash?
Well, I think that with the yield curve, this inverted, you are looking at a rates market that is suggesting the risk of hard landing is rising. Now, where I think the discontinuity is really more in the spread market, so in credit. So spreads are still on the narrow end of the recent ranges and of history. So that's where I would say more of the complacency is. But I think in the rates market itself, I think you are seeing the risk of over-tightening playing through within the very inverted yield curve.
I guess to put this another way, there's a feeling that even if we get some sort of recession or some sort of landing, aside from the no landing idea that people were talking about for a while, that we're going to have higher rates for longer. And that is a persistent theme, regardless of even a crash. Yep. Do you agree with that? Do you think that if the Fed does crash the economy, we will still end up with higher terminal rates for a longer period of time?
Yeah, so we do think that we're in a new regime. And the starting point of that new regime was the fact that this is the first hiking cycle in 30 years that the peak of that hiking cycle is higher than the prior one, right? So we were having higher or lower highs and lower lows for 30 years. That's the bull market of fixed income. We are now going in the opposite direction. So this is a meaningful shift because the next time that the Fed cuts, we don't think it's going to be back to the zero lower bound. So there is some changes that are happening here, but those are slow moving. There are still going to be cyclical shifts in yields throughout our broader structural view that we could be entering into a phase of higher highs and higher lows.
Let's pick up on that because I know Bob's given it a lot of thought as well. Kelsey, you and the team, are you thinking about repeated cycles of that over the next couple of decades? Is there reason to believe we've got tailwinds for it?
There are some reasons to believe, and obviously these are very abstract topics, things that we're not going to know until very, very far into hindsight.
Yeah.
But there are tailwinds as it relates to demographics here. We think that inflation structurally is not necessarily going to struggle as much to get to that 2% level. So if you think about pre-COVID, but post-GFC, it was very hard for the Fed to achieve 2% core PCE. In fact, on average, it was about 1.5%. So we were missing it to the downside by about 50 basis points all the time. Now, I think you can say maybe things have started to shift because of deglobalization, because of other factors, that it will be easier for the Fed to get to that 2%. You know, we're not suggesting a materially higher regime for inflation and rates, but it is one that is shifting over time.
Could be the last 30 years in reverse. Take care. This is a major call coming from the team. Kelsey, Bob,
this
over
is.
JP Morgan.
And the call here is you guys aren't leveraged players, but there's a huge part of the alternative investment in fixed income market that is utilizing leverage here. Did they get hammered yesterday? Is there a misuse of leverage right now?
So I think the strength of the move in twos yesterday clearly shows that some people were offsides, and there are positions that needed to be cleaned out. How's the Austria bond doing?
Oh, thank you.
Kelsey, you know what? That's the perfect place to leave it. Kelsey Barrow of JP Morgan Asset Management. That was golden.
And Alicia Levine with us right now, BNY Mellon. She's over there. It's like the Bramo cam was on her while you were talking, and she wants to jump in.
Good.
Respond to what we were talking about. This hurt.
Look, I think what Powell did yesterday was the right thing to do. The data has been hot, and if he didn't put 50 on the table, it then threatens a further loosening of financial conditions, which will unanchor inflation expectations. So he had to put it on the table. I actually think it was the right thing to do. But now the problem is he's locked in, because if they don't go 50, right, it's been a series of locking in. The Fed talks too much. I have thought that throughout this whole cycle. There's too much talk of disinflation 8 weeks ago, 13 times. But in the end, by putting 50 on the table in the near term, they're almost forced to go through it. I think a 200 number on Friday would do it.
I want to pick up on Lisa's theme of this morning so far. If 200K gets it done, it's a pretty low bar. Why are stocks so resilient?
That is confounding and the question of the year. And to your point, why was Nasdaq leading yesterday? So let's just point out that even after the price action yesterday, stocks were where they were on Thursday. And the disconnect between the bond volatility and what's happening in the stock market is ever widening this year, in year to date in 2023. The market has been remarkably resilient, as have credit spreads, as you've just talked about, which is what's holding up the market here. So I think what the market is seeing is that ultimately that 10 years having a hard time over 4%, and ultimately the 10-year is going to move lower because a slowdown will be coming. The Fed's going to wind up pushing us into recession.
So I get a lot of hate mail about being too gloomy and people who think that I always am glass half empty and just, you know, I should go have a little bit more fun. And so some people will say that, you know, if you take a look at
what's been going on,
I've been trying, and let's try to look at the bright side. Maybe stocks and credit spreads are seeing a picture that, you know, the rate volatility isn't. Maybe there is this resilience. Maybe that strength is, you know, going to carry through even if rates do go up to 6%. Do you buy that?
So I do buy the thought that the economy appears to be less sensitive to rate hikes than originally thought. I mean, we are now at 450, 475 in 12 months. Wither the crisis, wither the great knock-on effects. We're nowhere, okay? And I think that surprised a lot of us who've seen other rate cycles here. So that has to do with the fact that most of mortgages are fixed rate at 3%. People are making the spread on a 5% six-month treasury, right? So they're actually making money on this trade. But even if the economy is less resilient, the Fed will probably have to go higher and will eventually work. It's just going to take longer. The data and the real economy continues to be fairly strong. You're seeing weakening in certain parts of the economy, such as housing. Clearly, commercial real estate is at risk. That's flashing a warning sign here. But that's really the beginning of it. It just hasn't happened yet. As long as labor is strong and as long as workers are getting wage increases, which they are, you can keep this going further.
So what do you do with the idea of a 6% Fed funds rate? What do you do with a 50 basis point rate hike on March 22nd? How does that change what you buy?
So it's a really interesting thing. So far, cyclicals this year have worked, as have growth, right? And I think that begins to change a little bit. You have to think of this as if the Fed has to go to 6% or even higher, it's not our base case, but you have to start opening your mind to the fact that it could happen, then you start having to see a recession by the end of the year or even into 2024. The confounding part of this year is that the recession hasn't happened yet. And it's very hard to predict with the strength we see in other sectors, such as the service sector, which continues to hold up the economy. But you have to expect it within, let's say, the next 12 months. And with that, you do start asking the question, will cyclicals continue to outperform? And that's really where you have to go with this. Because the defensive stocks have been terrible this year, right? Healthcare's been tough. Staples have been tough. Utilities have been tough. And the cyclicals have ripped. So the question is, what happens if the recession really starts to be priced in?
I'm not going to mince. On International Women's Day, there are many women that have provided leadership, and you have with bulletproof mathematics and education. I mean, your path here was painful in terms of like the lean over the desk. Right now, we are at a moment where we've got massive first and second derivative moves, and it comes down to Nassim Taleb's math. The gravity's back. And as Taleb says, you got to have skin in the game, which means all the shadows are out there, all the worries are out there. And you study it on a tail with a Poisson distribution. We're not going to go into the math this morning. I'm not going to go into the math this morning. But are we there now where we've got legitimate tail risk of, as Alarion would say, the unknown unknowns out there?
Yes, we do. We've always thought that simply because we don't think you get out of a rate cycle that quickly. I think what's unspoken in this conversation today is the debt ceiling. That could change what the Fed does rather remarkably and rather quickly as well. And the fact that the U.S. hasn't had a recession in the third year of a presidential term because it's an election cycle coming up. What happens to the pressure on Powell if we actually get that recession by the end of the year? Can he finish the job? Yep. I don't think Powell's burns yet. The question is, will he be Burns in the future? I think for now, Powell's sticking to the Volcker playbook, and I think he's doing a pretty good job at it. The question is, if we get that recession, if your unemployment rate goes to 3.8% from here, which doesn't feel like a lot, he'll be getting pressure from the right and the left.
You're just much more diplomatic than I am, Alicia. You're going to stick with us. Alicia Levine there of BNY Mellon.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
You should point out that, well, on International Women's Day, you can be a reporter who says, well, I got a fancy degree from Chicago, but I know nothing about bonds. And through sheer inspiration and perspiration, you learn about bonds. What was it like, Lisa Abramowitz, your first day in the bond world?
Well, it was in 2007 in August when the commercial paper market was freezing
up.
So it was definitely a moment of real tension and drama that people don't associate with bonds.
Did you just pile up 15 books around you and just read Fabozzi cover to cover and the rest of it?
No, I called traders and a number of them cursed and hung up because that was the moment
that
we were in terms of the tense feeling. And I do wonder, we saw the lack of drama for a decade or more, almost two decades.
Yeah.
And here we are, and the drama
is getting back. Very 070. Someone that knows that is Diane Swank. She's chief economist at KPMG. And Diane, I'm just thrilled that you are here today. And I place you in a group with Abby Joseph Cohen of Goldman Sachs, now at Columbia University. And of course, the wonderful Sally Krawchuk as well, who changed securities research at Sanford Bernstein years ago. And then there was Swank in 1985. I think she was out of junior high school at the time. And she was in Chicago landing a job at First Chicago Corporation. What was it like the first day on the job, Diane? I mean, out of Michigan, it was unique at the time, right?
It was unique, and to be honest with you, then I went on to University of Chicago as well. But, you know, I rode up the escalator, and I often describe the person I was mentoring in the 80s, and that person was me, and I looked like a man in some ways with my short cropped hair, my male-dominated kind of women's suit, and I even had wingtip pumps, which says a lot, although I refused to wear those. I had bow tie, and I took it off. I just couldn't take it anymore, and I put it around my waist, which is kind of me as well. But, you know, until I got to step into, for me, my femininity, my career didn't take off, and luckily that occurred very shortly thereafter, and I had a terrific mentor. You always need someone that is a terrific mentor, and he once said to me, it's not that I'm altruistic, Diane. You make me look good.
What do we need to do forward on International Women's Day? I mean, there's all sorts of cohorts here and debates and that. Ms. Swank, you've lived it. What do we need to do forward to get more women into economics, finance, and investment?
What's really kind of a sad commentary, particularly in economics on the academic side. And, you know, the bottom line is that we need to all be able to step into our truth and who we are. And that is not allowed in a lot of these fields. And that's something that I have a really hard time struggling with because it took me a long time to do that. I had to work through two maternity leaves. My son almost died. I was on TV 4 weeks after I delivered my daughter. I don't wish that for anyone.
Yeah.
And the bottom line is we have to acknowledge the biology. And the biology is that women are delivering babies and, you know, same-sex couples are able to have children. We have to support paternity leave. And that is really important. We just don't do it. The fact that our female participation rate and our male participation rate among 25 to 54-year-olds, a group I no longer belong to, is the lowest in the G20, which is really the G19, because we don't include Russia anymore, that is really despicable. Our neighbors to the north, Canada, has a 12% higher participation rate among prime-age women than we do in the United States. So it's here with some, you know, I have a sadness to this day in the fact that I wasn't able to do more and I still got a lot of work to do for everyone behind me.
Lisa, why don't you pick it up here? I mean, there's some themes there that are really, really trenchant and how alone America is in this debate.
Well, I want to go to what you managed to accomplish in that time, Diane, which is an incredible reputation and prowess within the economics field at a moment that is highly tenuous. We're trying to put together a lot of real uncertainty into some sort of forecast. What did you make of what Jerome Powell said yesterday on Capitol Hill?
Well, you know, I thought he finally stepped into where we knew the Fed was, and the fact that all the headlines actually reported the same Chairman Jay Powell is really important, and that is they are data dependent. The data and the narrative has shifted, and that does put a 0.5% on the table. Now, could it change? There's two more key data points coming out before they meet on March 21st, but I think it's important that he laid out just how data dependent they are and the willingness to pivot. You got another Powell pivot, and that is that we could get a 0.5% at this next meeting and that rates are going higher faster. I think that's very important information to have. It's one that we've been arguing. And yes, the data has been out there officially since the Valentine's Day massacre of that inflation number we came out, but the revisions to that were out prior to that, the Friday before it. And we were looking at it going, oh my gosh, this has changed the entire narrative.
Well, is the data that we've gotten since then, and I think about the ADP data that a lot of people are dismissive of, has it confirmed that strength? Or is there any sign that perhaps we're going to see some sort of downward revision or some sort of downside surprise in labor market that has surprised for almost a year straight to the upside?
We certainly could see some cooling, and I think we are seeing some cooling, and I think the ADP data is now the way that they've redone it, and I give a lot of credit to Neela Richardson over at ADP for not making it a forecast of the official payrolls data. It is its own data set, but it still shows that there's a lot of strength in wage gains there. That's terrific for wage earners, but to the extent that we're seeing continued upward pressure on inflation tied to demand, which is tied to the wages people earn, that is a concern for the Fed. And I think that data, I mean, we know the month of January, part of the reason ADP's report was so weak was because it is more sensitive to the floods we saw in California. So people who didn't work the whole week didn't show up as much on payrolls in that week that was a survey week. It was not the same for the national data. If they got paid even a dime that week, they showed up on national payrolls. So I do think we'll see some downside surprises as well as we come off this, you know, unseasonably hot January in many ways. But the bottom line is you need the threshold to get us to the Fed feeling like it's actually got inflation under control and that inflation will not become a more entrenched inflation is very, very high. That means their threshold to slow down rate hikes is high right now.
Diane Swank, thank you for joining us today, of course, with KPMG. Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.